360 Yourself is a dedicated podcast meeting brilliant minds and looking at the world around them. How do they 360 themselves and 360 the world? Jamie Neal, the host, asks many questions about their mindset and how they fundamentally operate their world and the world around them. Hello and welcome back to 360 Yourself. I hope you're having a lovely, lovely day. So today I have the brilliant Toby. How are you doing, Toby?
Very good, thank you. Very good.
How are you spending your lockdown? Whereabouts are you at this moment in time?
At the moment I'm at home in which is in Surrey. I'm really lucky, really. So because I've got lots of space around me. Sort of quite a big garden, which is, you know, quite a handful to look after. But I just managed to get a new lawnmower, which has been brilliant, which means I can cut the grass and I don't have, normally I always have to go pick it up, which is the worst thing.
Oh, that's the annoying thing.
Take it to the compost. But this one, if I get it in time, if I can nick it, get it in the nick of time, when it hasn't grown too long, I don't have to, it goes back into the ground again. So you can cut it. And you don't have to pick it up, so that's brilliant.
That's really good. My dad's spending a lot of time in the garden. We got lots of land as well in Devon, and my dad just spends every single day in the garden perfecting it. And he's wounded all of us from the family all together to help with the garden. So I'm digging a lot and planting flowers, and I have no idea what I'm doing. But he's like the commander. He's just like, you do that, you do that, and we're like, okay, whatever you want me to do.
There's something
quite nice though about digging and sort of building a garden and seeing it when it's kind of fully made.
Yes, yeah, that sounds like a quite he sounds like he knows what he's doing. We just let ours run wild, actually.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I mean, but things do seem to grow. I mean, I've got a little there's a nice little wild patch, you know, that I just let grow long, and then it's basically, I mean, the lawn is in such bad nick, you know, that if I don't cut it, it'll just turn into some sort of field, you know.
So yeah
but otherwise my wife actually is a bit better than me, but I mean, we do sort of occasionally have to dig stuff up and deal with compost and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but I'm afraid I'm not a great gardener myself. But,
so
I do the essentials, you know, but it is quite big, you know, and as you say, yeah, if your parents live down with loads of space, you know, that is, you can quite get quite sort of overrun quite quickly. So you have to be careful.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Sometimes my dad gets my uncle down whenever because he's a builder. So he'll come down and stuff and that, and they'll do the garden. And then he goes away. And my dad will just carry on a potter and he'll do like little things kind of every day. But there's a lot of land and there's a lot of things he needs to do. But he kind of takes it day by day because he's like, we're in lockdown, so we might as well just do it day by day.
I know, no. So, yeah, so that, I've been doing that, and then I've been doing various. I mean, actually, it is funny that you sort of look inwards when you, obviously, because you can't go out. You start looking at your own space, actually, and you sort of think, actually, I really should start looking through those drawers. And, you know, then you start doing that, and then the amount of crap that comes out of them is just past stuff from the past, and you go, well, actually, that's been in a drawer, you know, or I'm trying to empty the, you know, the loft or something as well. So there's lots of bits and bobs like that, but otherwise I've actually been making some short films which I've put out actually on just as a, they're sort of less than 1 minute films, and it's just an idea that my wife and I had just to keep the old creative juices going.
No, that's good. That's, I think
I've been doing a bit of that.
Well, I think that's what you can be doing at this moment in time, is finding other creative adventures that you might not necessarily have the time for in your normal life.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I've been doing a bit of that, which is good.
And have you always have you been based in Surrey all your life then? Or did you live anywhere else?
No. I used to live in London. I used to live in Wandsworth for most part, I suppose, in what was called it's still called the Royal Victoria Patriotic Building, which is, in fact, it's an asylum. It's an old asylum. Over Wandsworth, not far over Wandsworth Bridge, going, I think it's along Trinity Road it was, and it was an amazing Victorian building. So I lived there, and then and it was amazing, actually. It was bought for £1 off the council by a guy called Paul Tutton, who used to own Tutton's Restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And he came up with an idea, and so long as he renovated it, which it needed a lot of renovation, I think it's been through various things. It was a hospital during the Crimean War, I think, and then was used in the Second World War, and then was left, I think. So it had a lot of pigeons lived there, and all the windows were broken, but it was the most amazing building. So you could buy, you bought what you could afford, and you paid per square meter of these massive old wards, hospital wards, and they're beautiful space with huge windows and stuff. So I sold the house that I was at down in Battersea.
Mm-hmm.
And just moved in, and there were lots of really quite interesting people who I discovered there. And later there was a drama school, I think ALRA is still there, I think, I don't know, but there were lots of sort of quite creative people living there. And it was great fun, really good.
It's nice when you have a community of creatives. I don't live there, but I used to live in Shoreditch in February. Oh, yeah. And I love Shoreditch. It was so full of creative people, and it was always quite nice and friendly, and I kind of loved that.
Yes, I bet. No, it is. It is nice. I do like that environment. I mean, you don't have to sort of see them every day, but, you know, it is nice. Yeah, it's a nice feeling.
Mm-hmm. And so I know you from many, many productions of brilliant things like Frankenstein and War Horse and Nanny McPhee and all these brilliant accolades. So what I want to know is, take me from the start. How did you become into the arts, and how do you go? Because you were also trained at Le Coq as well in Paris.
Yes.
So tell me from the start.
I was trying to think, actually, because I thought you might ask something about like your influences and things. And I was trying to think who directly. I mean, it's not really people like, you know, Charlie Chaplin or Laurel and Hardy. Although I know more about Laurel and Hardy, actually, because I did a film recently about them. But it's not really, you know, a lot of people think, oh, well, he must have come from that world, but it wasn't really that. And I was thinking what influenced your life, you know, really your life before you even know what you're going to do. And I suppose, my most vivid memories, I suppose, of my youth were one that I was always sort of trying to make people laugh, at school or whatever the situation, or my family or my brothers and stuff like that. So there was that, and I think that came out of I was very when I was quite young, we used to go we used to go on holiday camping a lot, not many people in those days, in English people anyway, did that. And we used to go to like Normandy and Brittany in northern France with a couple of minis, you know, with like loads of tents, with a whole tents on the roof and stuff, all packed up, but massive, great old, those old canvas tents, you know. And we used to go to camping on, and the only people there really were French, other French sort of tourists. There were hardly any English. We hardly ever met English people. So one, you know, I learned to speak French at a very young age, but also we used to go, I think it was like Friday night, Friday, Saturday, Sunday or something. They'd have like traveling circuses in the sort of little villages near the campsites and stuff. And And so I was really keen to go and see these. I just, for some reason, I just really became very in love with the circus. And so I used to go and watch. So my, you know, my parents used to take us to go and see these things. And all I remember getting an incredibly stiff neck. And I don't know whether that was like the tension of watching everything or looking up at the trapeze artists and stuff. But they weren't like huge circuses. They were like small family affairs. But they were brilliant, and the clowns were very good. And so I guess that was sort of a base. And when I was about 12 or 13, I always wanted to run away to the circus, which sounds a real... I mean, that is the biggest cliche, and I probably heard it in a movie or something. But I did seriously want to do that. And then when I left school, I went to drama school for a couple of years. It wasn't that impressed. It was a very good base training. And actually, while I was there, there was the brilliant, the most brilliant teacher I had there was Keith Johnston, who later wrote, he's an incredible impro teacher. You probably heard, he wrote this book, Impro, which has become like a Bible, really, for any sort of theatre actor in that time, I suppose.
Yeah.
And he was involved with a company called Theatre Machine, which was run by, I think it was Roddy Maud Roxby, Jim Morgan, and Ben Bennison was another teacher. And when Keith wasn't around, he used to teach improvisation. And if he wasn't there, then Ben Bennison would come in and teach. So, and I think that was the bit, that was the most exciting aspect of the drama school, really. I mean, he used to do crazy, you know, ridiculous stuff. He used to take the whole class out on the underground, and we used to do impros involved with the public in undergrounds. You know, we never used to upset them or anything, but we used to do certain improvisations or things at Waterloo Station. You know, we'd all like hide behind newspapers. The class would literally watch one person improvise with someone else, and Keith would just be around to sort of supervise.
That's brilliant.
It was incredible. So you really put yourself in it, you know. And so that they were great experiences, and he was a great teacher. So I was very inspired by him. And then I went to the Lecoq School after that. And I guess it was quite interesting because I was always very keen. I was very keen on I did like the fact of, like, Marcel Marceau. I was very impressed by him when I was in my young teens, I suppose, that he could entertain. He could literally just stand on stage and entertain a fully packed Sadler's Wells theatre. Yeah. So I thought, oh, that's pretty good. You know, how do you? And he does it with nothing on stage. It was like this mime, you know, that he used to do. So, and I wasn't so impressed. I think it was very, that I didn't like the sort of the technical mime, but I did like the freedom of inspiring the audience's imagination because there's nothing there. You know, you can make up things, you make up situations or stories or whatever that aren't there. There's nothing there on stage. And I thought that's a brilliant idea. So I got very interested in that, but I did find him he was like a purist, you know. It's like the ballet of mime, really. It's very technical, and that aspect I didn't find so attractive. But the storytelling, the possibilities, I found very inspiring. And then I went to see a guy called Julian Chagrin, who was a guy. I later found out that he went to the Jacques Lecoq School. But he was brilliantly funny. He was way ahead of his time as well, as far as the things that he was writing and doing were sort of mime, but not mime like Marcel Marceau. You know, he used to make up stories and just stand on stage and storytell and create things. And I thought, oh God, that's brilliant. So I went round and I saw him afterwards in the dressing room. And I'll never forget the conversation I had with him. And I went around and asked, I said, I want to do, how can I learn to do what you do? And then I mentioned, you know, that I'd been to Marcel Marceau and I'd seen a lot of his performances, but that wasn't quite right. And he said, well, if you want to, okay, I'll give you an example. He said, if you want to do a man who is walking in the wind, you know, with blustery wind, you know, being blown about by the wind.
Mm.
If you just play the man in the wind, then that's the Marcel school. But if you want to play the wind and play the effect that it's having on the overcoat that you're wearing, or the effect that the trees the effect the wind has on the trees or on the rooftops or you know, just in the street in general, then you go to Jacques Lecoq. And I said, oh great, okay, I'll go to the Lecoq school.
Wow.
And but that's basic.
But it's also a very established school as well to get into.
It was.
Yeah.
Sorry, the Lecoq school.
Yeah, very, very established school to get into. And it's very, I've never been, but I've heard it's very intense.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it was, well, in those days, I mean, it was, yes. But in those days, it was before he had the boxing school. It was before he had the building that now is the sort of the famous school. He was basically hiring out rooms when I went. Although it was, you know, it was, yeah, I guess it was difficult. It was difficult. It wasn't that difficult to get in if you had the money. I think I got a grant from the Arts Council or Gil Benkin or something like that. But it was, it was very difficult to stay there because, you know, you had to have a certain outlook on what you wanted to do. And you had to have a certain understanding about Lecoq's pedagogy and about his teaching.
Mm.
And if it didn't, you know, it doesn't, he wasn't worried about if, you know, you could be brilliant and still not be the right person to do his school. I'll never forget, he always used to say that, you know, so, you know, he basically at the end of the first, you'd start off with about 100, just over 100 students for the first year, and they were split into three groups. And then in the second year, he would literally cut everything down to about 25 students. So a lot of people would be asked to leave at the end of the first year.
Wow.
Yeah, hell of a cut down. I mean, basically the second year was literally just a laboratory for a very small number of students, the second year. And then obviously when the second year was going, the first year would be there again. You know?
It's really important though, I find that it's really important to have small numbers to really focus and really have intelligent and really nourishing training. Because I went to Rombert and we had literally about 20, 25 people, and the same for Royal Ballet. They have small numbers. I think when colleges have like 100 like plus, it's so difficult to really have really succinct, intelligent training and really one-to-one relationship.
Exactly. No, I think that's absolutely true. Yeah. It's like if you're teaching, you know, there is a maximum amount. You can't, otherwise it almost becomes like a lecture. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's very different. Yeah. Yeah. Mm.
And I read that you founded the Moving Picture Mime Show, which is kind of like the birth of kind of physical theatre, which I know from, well, I started doing physical theatre when I was, I think, 14, 15. I was lucky enough to be a part of Told by an Idiot, the company, a small role in my local theatre, Plymouth Theatre Royal. And that was when I started understanding what physical theatre is, because before that I was doing ISTD jazz and that sort of thing, and then I stumbled upon your name and that sort of thing, and I was like, oh my god, okay, this is really interesting.
Yes, that was the start. It really, yeah, I guess we started Moving Picture Mime Show, and that, yeah, it's true, in those days there wasn't a great deal of that. Of certainly we opened up a whole new book, I think, as far as a style of theatre. In those days, you know, when we came back from Paris and started the company, and it was like a huge success very quickly, you know. I mean, we got one review, I think, by a guy called John Percival in the Times, and in those days reviews were really important, you know, much more so than today, because I mean, you know, there were no mobiles and laptops, and you know, the news would spread in a very different way. And the way people saw things was very different as well. So it was, but I remember all you needed was one good review, and then you were made, you know.
Yeah.
especially if you had a review in Time Out or something like that, which we were, they used to follow us a lot, you know. And they loved, you know, they'd take certain people under their wing, it felt like.
Yeah. They would popularize someone and they would push this person or this the company if they liked them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like Michael Clarke and things like that.
Mm.
Or dancers like that. I remember it was around the same with Michael. I used to know him, you know, reasonably well when we were sort of around the same time, I guess. We all used to go and see. He used to come and see us, and we used to go and see him and stuff. Moving picture. I think it was the style that we were. I mean, we were, but basically, it did come. It fulfilled that early dream that I was talking about earlier about being able to stand on stage and create a story through a series of images for an audience with hardly anything there. Most of the time we had very few props. Occasionally some of our shows would change, you know, and but the basic style, you know, things like we did a production of The Seven Samurai, which was the Kurosawa film, and with just three of us, you know, and to tell, and it was like telling the whole, you know, we tell the whole story, but in a very sort of cartoon style way. And I guess that at that time, I think there was also the aspect I was very keen. I think inherent in my youth really was I used to love and watch a lot of cartoons. Things like Tom and Jerry and earlier stuff like Cab Cabal at Calloway and stuff like that. The thing about the cartoon is that it's a slight extension of reality.
Mm.
You know, everything is slightly over the top. So there'll be whatever the concept is, it'll be taken just that little bit further. You know, I don't know, especially in like a Tom and Jerry thing, you know, some of the, you know, very simple storylines, but whatever, that's not really the point. But the way that something evolves, the way that a storyline evolves and the way that the gag works is always slightly over the top, slightly almost absurd, you know. And I think that's quite an interesting level. Like we would take an idea and then we would make it slightly absurd. We would go to the slight absurd level of it. Extreme, you know, in a way, and Lecoq used to call that a treatment of something. In other words, when you know, there's a very, where there's one sort of straight storyline, and then there's a treatment of a storyline, which everything is slightly exaggerated, and that creates more of a, it's more of a performance level, I suppose.
Of course, of course. And how did you get into more the theatre work then? Because obviously you've worked on so many brilliant productions, and how did you then move into the kind of film and TV stuff?
Yeah, well, I was just asked by people to, if they say, can you come and help? You know, I've got this scene. You know, it would start off being quite specific. And then director, I'd work, you know, quite well with directors who would have a vision of something, but not, they wouldn't quite know how to go about getting it. Because of Moving Picture Mime Show, that the way of storytelling, it became quite attractive in those days to a lot of people, and they thought, and they would think, oh well, you know, there's a different way of telling something, of explain, you know, of working through something, and it basically, that's how it sort of started. And as a movement director, that's how it started, you know. Yeah. And then you'd do more and more, you know, you'd do certain scenes in certain plays, you know, that would have an effect, or you'd take over the whole play, you know. You do, I mean, something like The Tempest, you know, would be, which I did, you know, up in Manchester or something, would be with Pete Postlethwaite. And there, you know, I'd be in it. A lot of the things I would be in as well, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a lot of the stuff. That became, and I never found that particularly difficult, but I would be doing the movement and I'd be in it. And I mean, that happened all the way up to Warhorse as well, which is a whole, although that was over a much longer period of time. you know, over 2 or 3 years of workshopping and stuff beforehand. But yeah, when we basically started, yes, I was an actor, or I was asked to come along to that workshop as one of the actors from the National, really.
Ah.
And that's how it started, you know. And then because I happened to have done a lot of movement, I sort of took over the phenomena when once we got the puppets, you know. I took over the idea of turning the horses, the puppets into horses, just because it was an analysis of movement, you know, that I've always been quite specific on.
Mm.
And that's sort of fundamentally the basis of that sort, that aspect of movement direction.
And was there not a movement director on War Horse when it first started, or was you the first person to kind of
it was me I was the movement director right from the beginning, where eventually, you know, it was literally after the first or second workshop I would start. I think Tom Morris, who was sort of running it, and Adrian and Basil, who were from Handspring Puppets, you know, together we would all start the idea of the horse, of choreo, you know. And then later on it became it was down to me to choreograph. Certain things are choreographed and a lot of things are left sort of improvised. You know, it's always been, once the puppeteers understand how to move the horse, you know, then there are certain aspects of things there are certain moves that are, I teach them how to do it in order to make it look like a horse.
Yeah.
But in the, you know, and then there'll be specific moments like, you know, a charge where you've got all the horses and all the other horses to choreograph their deaths or something like that. I would choreograph to find the most dynamic way to use the puppet as a horse, you know, dying, for example, the most explosive, most visual way,
yeah,
to see the horror, that sort of thing, that would be choreographed. But a lot of the other, when the horses are just being horses, then they're really, it's up to them just to be real horses. I always said to them, you know, they must always be you must never be certain as to what they're going to do. Unpredictable. The horses, in order to be a horse, it has to be total, and any animal on stage has to be totally unpredictable. If it's always under control, then it's just a puppet, basically.
Yeah, and you did the incredible 39 Steps as well, which is brilliant. How did that come about?
Yes, well, that was I think Mariah Aitken, who was the director of that. I think again, it was that aspect of poor theatre, really, of making things out of nothing, you know, creating images out of very simple props. And I think she'd obviously seen, you know, I mean, there's various things I'd done before then, things like Ben Hur or the Nativity, or God, I mean, I got, when I look through the stuff, I mean, there's sort of a lot over the years, really, and you don't know. And then one thing just really has always just led to another, really. It was probably through Moving Picture Mime Show, I think, that she thought, oh, well, if anybody's going to, you know, make up this ridiculous story. And also it was with Patrick Barlow, who I had known for quite a while as well, and got to know very well during that. So I guess it was just, I think that's how that started. And that was, so most of all the, you know, ideas, all the train and everything, all came out of just me working with the actors. You know, I mean, the script was there, but not how anything was done.
Yeah. And because you are essentially a movement director and a director, because there's a very blurred line between what is, because obviously maybe years and years and years ago there was a director and they would do the musical, the staging, the musical staging, and working with kind of the characterization. I'd say you're more of a director than you are a movement director. How do you kind of have that relationship with a director when it is working on a production?
I think they have a lot of faith in what you put forward, you know, which means, ultimately, Yeah, it's an interesting thing, really, because I suppose, yes, you are, I am directing something in that, you know, you're putting almost a finished product of that, of a certain part of the story on stage. So I suppose, yeah, you develop a very good working relationship. Most directors, in fact, I haven't really had any big problems. I'm just trying to think. I probably won't mention the name anyway. But in general, you know, I get on very well. You know, someone like Danny Boyle, for example, he's great to work with. And that just literally came out of a conversation years ago when I went up for, as an actor, that was actually, I went up for, and I got the part as the priest in 28 Days Later.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the film, yeah.
In the film, yeah, with Cillian Murphy and stuff. And that was, so basically I got that just as an actor. And then it was only really with talking with Danny about the movement, you know, about the movement quality of that we wanted to, you know, I was, you know, when we're talking about the priest who's one of the infected, and basically we just started talking, and then I started saying, you know, the various exercises that I think we should do, and so I ended up doing most of the sort of giving a whole workshop with all the actors about infected, about how to move and about levels of tension and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I basically, that became a lot more than being just the actor on it. It was sort of became the sort of movement director on the film. And that just literally came out of a conversation talking with Danny, you know, and then after that, we got on really well, and he liked, you know, what I did and stuff. And it sort of grew from there, really. And then he asked me to do, I did some work on a very small amount on Sunshine, I think was another film. He did. And then he asked me to Frankenstein. But it's an odd thing, really, because, yeah, as far as directing, basically, I suppose, you know, I mean, I've directed, if you direct something, you take over the whole show, basically. You know, you take over all the rehearsals, you take over the concept, everything, the responsibilities, I guess, is quite massive. So I mean, I guess that's the basic difference between being if you are just the movement director, then the job is a lot more specific, and there's a lot less responsibility.
So
I don't mind, I mean, you know, but that's the big difference. So if you know, in that I am directing, as it were, it's not as big a responsibility as being the director, which I have been on quite a few productions. I've directed myself, you know, and there you do take over the whole thing. You know, you're responsible with the designer, with the lighting designer, with the costume, with everything.
Basically. Yeah, yeah, for sure. And
so, I mean, as you know, so there is a big difference. So when you say, you know, oh, you are almost directing, I am, as far as the artistic side, but not as the full job as a director in those cases when I'm working with Danny or any other theatre director or film director.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I work in the commercial side of things. It's like we call them the creative director. So like, uh-huh. So Danny would be like the creative director, and you would sort of like be the artistic director, the movement director, theatre director. But the Danny or whoever the director would be the artistic overall thing. So there's no in the commercial world, there wouldn't be a blurred line between my job and the creative director, because the creative is literally the driving force of the vision. It's just interesting when you are working in the space and you're working on a scene and it has text in it, but you're turning the text into movement. And then how do you have that kind of relationship with the director? I think a lot of movement directors have their own process of how they work with the director. But also another one that you notably did was the Stan and Ollie with Steve Coogan and John Reilly, which I love so much, and it's such a brilliant story and the part of our history. How did that come about, and how was the process of that?
Yeah, that was a lovely it was a lovely job. I guess it was because I've directed a lot of that sort of comedy. And it was really just meeting, I just was phoned up, had a long I went to see Faye Ward, who's a lovely she runs Fable Picture Producer. I had a long chat with her. And I don't know how it came. I mean, I guess they've just seen past stuff that I've done, you know, comedy things that I've written and things. But I mean, that was a great it was a great opportunity, really. I mean, they basically gave me the whole box set. I mean, as I said, you know, Laurel and Hardy, I'd seen loads of the Laurel and Hardy films in my youth and stuff. So I knew quite a lot about the characters and how they moved, and you know, and that. So I did a lot of research into what, into their backgrounds and things like that. And I mean, but the best thing really was, and then John S. Baird, the director, we hit off immediately. He gave me a lot, I said, look, in order to do this, you know, really, we're going to need to rehearse a lot before we start filming, because there's nothing worse than being unprepared. You know, if you're trying to get a routine together and you're trying to film it, there's no way you can do those two things at the same time. So I said, I wanted at least, you know, 3 or 4 weeks solid rehearsal with Steve and John, just by themselves, with John S. Baird, you know, if he wanted to come into rehearsals. And basically that's because I had a lot of, I wanted to write, or rather the script allowed me to write various scenes. You know, like there's a moment where they go into the reception up in Newcastle, and there's a receptionist, I can't remember if you remember, and they basically Stan comes in with all the luggage behind
it's near towards the beginning of the film, isn't it?
and there's a whole thing with the bell on the bell for the bellboy,
yeah,
you know, on the desk counter.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and where eventually Ollie takes his hat off and goes ding and puts it on the bell. And then there's the, yeah, well, I had to write that basically as a sort of a comedy sketch, but it was lovely to be able to write in the vein of Stan and Ollie, of how they would have written.
Mm-hmm.
And there was the other big scene was the Two Doors sequence at the railway station, which was something they did on stage. And basically that's never been filmed, so it's basically was a blank, it was a blank canvas.
Oh wow.
And John just said, okay, this is the situation, there are two doors and they can't find each other, they keep missing each other. So I wrote that whole, and that was like pure physical comedy.
And
that was great. And John and Steve weren't that confident about that, and it was literally and they really didn't believe that sort of physical comedy would stand up on its own. And so finally, when we actually got to shoot it, like I rehearsed it so that they knew it absolutely. It's actually a really difficult sequence to get right. You know, it looks very simple, but the amount of work, which is what Stan and Ollie used to do, you know, they used to spend so long rehearsing something that would just look so simple and just pass by in a film. It took months, you know, weeks to rehearse. Just simple things like a hat routine, you know, where he keeps getting the wrong hat. I worked on that with Steve and John, and it was incredibly complex and had to be very precise. So that was a real joy to work. And when it all worked, you know, they absolutely loved it. You know, and we got on really, really well.
Yeah.
You know, when we.
So
that was great, and they were both lovely to work with.
Because you have such a massive toolbox of character development and understanding how people operate and what makes people tick. How do you work with an actor when you're developing a character and their process?
Yes, well, you I suppose a lot of it is again, I come back to that thing of analysis of movement. You know, why do a gesture then, and what sort of gesture, and trying to warm up the actor to come up with initial ideas. I think it's always a process where you never give everything to the actor.
Mm.
The actor always, I always try to bring out as much as I can of the actor, of himself, of what he thinks one should do. Mm. And generally you can normally dirige, you can guide that. You can guide his input or his or her input. So that's sort of a starting point, because I always feel that to get the best results, it has to come from them, even if it's even if you sort of manipulate it with their, you guide them with their, with them being totally okay about it.
Mm.
But I think it is important that it's like a clown, a clown routine. You have to believe the clown. You have to believe in order for it to be funny and in order for it to be work.
Mm.
The clown has to absolutely believe that what he's doing is truthful.
Yes.
And that's the essence of clown, and I think that's the essence of almost anything of an actor, saying a line or moving from A to B. If he doesn't feel that it's truthful to himself or herself, then it won't work. The audience will see through it.
Mm.
It's incredible how perceptive an audience can be about simple belief, believing in a gesture or in an emotion being put across by an actor.
Mm.
So I think that's something, that's the starting point, really. Mm. And then you just sort of guide them, you guide an actor very carefully with suggestions and warmth, really.
Yeah, it's amazing how nowadays movement direction is becoming more of a thing within theatre and film, because I can imagine maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, it was still quite relatively new and directors didn't know how to work with movement, because they thought, I'm a director, I should be doing the movement. And now there's a massive community of movement directors working from theatre to live to fashion to commercials to film. It's such a brilliant kind of new sort of thing, and I truly believe that you're one of the people that has been pushing the title of movement directors within theatre and helping directors understand and educating them what actually is.
Yes, yeah. I mean, it does seem there are a lot of movement directors about now. Whether it's whether it's valid for everything, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, my only, I guess it's sort of fundamental worry is that why, a certain amount, the actors are quite able, maybe to come up with a lot of the stuff themselves.
Mm.
I don't know.
Maybe
it's an interesting thing.
Yeah, it's a safety thing, because I know probably two or three really top movement directors who solely just work on films, and they're brilliant, and they work with very particular actors and follow them on their journey of film progresses.
Yes.
and help them develop their characters, and they're brilliant in that. And then within the fashion world, there's also movement directors that just help the models just become more at ease when it happens to the fashion show and that sort of thing. So yeah, I think it all depends on the project, I think, and who you're working with.
Because you've done a lot, haven't you? Anyway,
not a bit
as well.
Pardon?
Amazing. You've done a lot and very varied as well. It's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, it's because of I don't know, my ambitiousness and curiosity of wanting to explore different avenues and going and just saying yes to a lot of them as well, yeah. And seeing the opportunity. I think it's because for me, movement director wasn't a thing that I knew about until probably like, I don't know, 6-7 years ago. Like I thought the difference between a choreographer and a movement director was the same thing for years and years, right. And years, and I didn't know exactly what a movement director actually was, because I would class them as a choreographer. And it only was only when I went to Romba and I did my training that I actually realized the difference in of what movement direction is, and understanding that and knowing that everything within, even if it's a small gesture, is movement, not choreography. Where it can be an eye or anything like that. And I think that I looked in other avenues within outside of theater to go, how can movement direction be applied to this? People now are looking at the future of what movement can be, and now it's even going into how do you movement direct a computerized actor or model in a computerized world? Because at the moment, that's the next step. Because we're working digitally during this lockdown, people are devising AI computerized things. I remember I had to do a project, a job where I had to do the movement direction for the robot.
Wow.
And that was a quite interesting. And then also there's other friends of mine who are developing computerized models for fashion designers to do shows in a virtual reality, where you would get a movement director to movement direct the computerized model in that world.
Wow.
which is a totally new generational thing, but it's just like, I always say the difference between movement direction and choreography is that movement is everything. It can just be sitting down, winking, like the way that you just raise your shoulder, the way that you breathe out is all movement. And sometimes I'm on a commercial and it'll be as simple as that person looked a bit stiff sitting down. But I'm like, there's so many ways to sit down. Like, what's the intention of the sitting down? And because obviously within commercials, it's so quick and so paced, so fast. Yeah. They don't look at the details of it. And sometimes it just needs that movement director to go, actually, I understand what you're trying, what the whole brief is, what scenario is, how that person's moving, and why he's not breathing in a certain area of his body or releasing a certain piece of tension to actually get the ease and the effortlessness that the director or the client wants. And it's simple as breath. A lot of time breath can really, I'm sure you know, breath can really help everything because it's the tension.
Exactly. No, that's very true. I mean, it's all those elements, isn't it? It's extraordinary. But that must be really weird though, to because there you've got no input, from the robot at all.
No. It's
you're just having to
put
everything on him, which would be quite, I mean, it's quite an interesting task to be set, isn't it?
Yeah, I think because obviously they'll have the coders and that sort of thing, but obviously they don't know what looks good on a body. But obviously the body is a robot, so they need an outside art. It's like motion capturing when they do for films. It's a similar thing, but not. It's like, there is someone who's brilliant at coding and doing the movement graphics, but they need someone, a choreographer, a movement director, to come in and help what looks good from a physical point of view when they get the actors in and doing that sort of thing. So it was a very interesting project, and I think that might slightly be the future in 10 years, 12 years time, where technology becomes so more advanced that you will have more computerized things and more AI robots, and they'll need to have to do movement. But I hope that human interaction and human entertainment doesn't seize up too much compared to how we're advancing.
Yeah, yeah. Because there was that worry a few years ago where they were thinking that robot, you know, that AI would take over film, you know, the potential of what actors could do and what, you know, AI could do in its place. It's quite interesting. Yeah, I mean, that seems to have subsided, but it can always come back, you know, especially now.
Yeah, there's nothing like having that kind of experience watching someone perform on stage, and I know that you're producing your one man show.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, and so my one of my questions is about the kind of self awareness, because this podcast talks about kind of being aware of oneself to understand how the world and world operates around you. Do you find kind of inspiration, or where do you go for that? Whether that's going the same route every single day to your local coffee shop or art pieces, or where do you find that kind of sense of inspiration?
God, yeah, that's really difficult. I think a lot of it's due to observation. But then again, I mean, you know, obviously I have to be, you know, you have to go out of your house, you know, like, I mean, there are places where, you know, where it's best to observe, but I mean, I look at people a lot. I look at people a lot. Sometimes I follow people if they're interesting, you know, to see what they're going to do. You know, if there's someone particularly interesting or in a specific state or something, just walking along the street if you've got time, you know. I mean, not follow them, not for ages, but just to see where a small story might end, you know. So there's a lot of situation stuff I look at, I guess, that you pick up on. But I mean, I guess that, you know, that in a way I do miss a lot of that, because I don't I don't live in London anymore, so there is that, the stimulus is slightly different. It's really difficult to say. I don't know where it comes from. One is constantly thinking of things. If you do have an interest in, like, there's a character that I've sort of, well, that's what this short film's about, and it could be an aspect of this one man show that I still am thinking of, but haven't, you know, I haven't formulated any solid ideas about it, but which I do find quite frustrating, really. But as whether to, you know, whether it's based, whether it's thing aspects of my own, of looking into myself, and it being about aspects of my own life, you know, rather than it being a story about someone else. I suppose if there is a character starting in your head, you know, that you have and you've played around a bit with, then that does become a source of inspiration, and you do start putting. Just subliminally, almost, or even just thinking about putting a character in a certain situation, like what would he do now, or what would he do in that situation, you know. So I suppose that, you know, there are thoughts like that constantly come up. But I must say, I mean, it's not the most ideal. A lockdown is not the best. You don't really, you know, you can't really, there's not much to observe, to be honest.
So at the moment, you can only go potentially inwards then, because what I find fascinating is when artists are off balance, like not having a good day, and that also births new kind of creative ideas, but also the world shifts around you because you're slightly off balanced, and maybe because of this lockdown or in normal life, when you are slightly off balance and you're working on a comedy piece, that obviously is going to be affected.
Yes.
Because the way that you are centered.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, sorry.
No. Yeah, I mean, I guess. Yeah, I don't know about being off balance. It's sort of more. It's a funny thing of being in limbo.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, in the same time, but that's it's an interesting state because in limbo, you know, ideas and thoughts. Sometimes, you know, in limbo, if you let your mind completely go, just try to not think of anything, it is extraordinary how things come into your mind out of nowhere, you know, because you've just let everything go.
Mm.
Like, you know, being in a state at the moment where, you know, there is nothing, you're not really thinking. You don't know where the next thing is going to be, you know, when the next job is going to be, what it's going to be, what you've got to think about at the moment.
Mm.
So in a way, you know, you do, that is a funny state, but it can be quite a creative thing because, you know, your mind, it is, you slowly start to think, actually, your mind is always working, no matter, you know, it does not stop really anyway.
Yeah.
It's always coming up with something. But if you can channel that, you know, it's like trying to get it into a state of emptiness. And then it's like, you know, think suddenly something will just come round the corner. And I always find that interesting. You know, something will come out of nowhere. A thought will just perk up. You know,
and but where do you think these ideas come from? Because we all there's that thing of subconscious thoughts that are not actually your thoughts that just come into your brain, but it's deciphering what is actually your thought and what's a subconscious thought. So when you have a really great idea, where does it come from?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is quite strange. Yeah. I mean, you know, a lot of things. I mean, you do get, there are a lot of. People coming up completely from a different world come up with the same idea. That's really strange as well.
Yeah, I've had that before with people.
Really?
Yeah, I've had that before. A couple of years ago, I was developing something, and someone else came up with the same idea, and I was like, "How's that even possible?"
Yeah, I'm sure that has happened. Yeah, that has happened to me definitely over the years, where you've had an idea, and you've suddenly seen something. Almost, I mean, like too similar, you know, and you go, wow, that is extraordinary. It's like a doppelganger, you know.
Yeah, part of me believes it's electro waves going into the space for some, because the law of attraction, and if you believe in that. And another part of me is that subconscious thoughts are triggered by things that you see. So maybe that you and this person have subconsciously seen something, past something, at the same time or different times, and you've locked it back in your brain, and something has triggered it at the same time.
Yes,
and that's for me is quite interesting.
It is definitely yeah.
But it's I find it fascinating that limbo stage is when you are. What happens to the world around you, and when you are aware that you are in a limbo space, how do you manage the world? Because the world is moving forward, it's moving as it normally is, but you are in limbo. How do you personally, when you're not in lockdown, how do you manage your space when you're in limbo? Because we all can't be on point all the time. We all have good days and bad days. How do you kind of manage that?
I think how do I manage it? I don't know really. I'm not sure. Maybe you just keep yourself.
Do you use that space within your work, or do you kind of try to override your brain to get back on point? And is there tools that you use?
It's a really weird one.
It's a tricky one, isn't it? It's very tricky.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. If I'm, I think, yeah, there's quite a big, if I'm working, then I'm literally, then, you know, your thoughts are, everything is at the forefront, you know, the work is at the forefront. So yeah, you really don't have, I mean, I'm constantly thinking of the project in hand, basically.
Mm.
You know, and that, and so that's an easy one. I think it's when you're not working that you can, you know, your train of thought can drop, or you can go, like you said, you can go sort of in limbo in a way.
Yeah.
I think you just have to a certain amount of letting things go and just letting things be, you know, letting things be as they are around you. And, you know, I mean, something will always happen. A thought, as I said earlier, a thought or something will always come in.
Mm.
You know, it's a matter of, I don't think you don't actually ever stop.
Mm.
So in a way, I don't, I guess it doesn't really worry me that much.
Mm.
But I don't sort of, I'm just trying to think when you say what tool, you know, I don't know quite what tools, I wouldn't really, be able to express what tools I use to bring any thoughts about. I don't really do that. I guess they just sort of, they just come into your head.
Really. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. You know? Just to finalize, what I find really helpful for me is having kind of the comfort of people's processes and thoughts. And for me, it's like when people have these brilliant phrases or quotes, and I always remember these quotes when I'm in good times and bad times. Are there any kind of outstanding quotes that you've ever come across when you were a child, or even now, that you always go, okay, now I revert back to that?
Oh, well, I don't know if it's not really a quote, but it's actually something that I was thinking about. It's a simple poem, actually, by a guy called Kurt Vonnegut.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of makes it as a quote, or it's definite statement.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell it to you, and then you tell me whether it is.
Yes, please.
I mean, it's basically a short poem, and it goes, we do doodly do doodly do doodly do what we must, muddly must, muddly must, muddly must. Muddly do, muddly do, muddly do, muddly do, until we bust, bodily bust, bodily bust.
Wow.
So, and that's...
It's quite profound, isn't it?
That's something, that sort of keeps me going, because that's all you've got, you know, that's what life is, really. That's, I've never forgotten that. I can't remember what, I think it was from Wampetus and Graham Falloons. He's a great writer. He was a lovely writer. I remember reading a lot of Kurt Vonnegut when I was younger.
Mm.
I ought to have a look at some of his stuff now. But he wrote things like Slaughterhouse-Five and Breakfast with Champions and Piano Player Piano, Breakfast of Champions. Yeah, loads of other really extraordinary. He's quite surreal writer, quite extraordinary writer. But I just never forget that, and I can't remember. I've used it, and in fact, we used it as a moving picture mime show. Used it as a as the words for one of the pieces that we did in the program notes for one of the pieces as an explanation of what it's about. And that was a mask piece called "Handle with Care," which was about two old men in an old nursing home. And it was a very powerful masterpiece. It was actually Jacques Lecoq's favourite piece that we ever did, apart from the Seven Samurai, but as a masterpiece. And it's like a 40-minute, it's like the whole half of an evening show, all in masks. And it was a very powerful story to do in full masks.
Mm.
And it basically, that was about life. You know, it was about the life of these two old men, and the fact of being, but the actual story had huge sort of ramifications, you know, about society, how society put people away in old people's homes when they still actually have a brain and a functioning brain, you know, and things like that. They're just basically left there. Mm. So it was basically, and then the nurse who sort of symbolizes how much time and effort is spent on looking after people in general, you know. Mm. So in fact, it's quite sort of it's quite powerful now, I suppose.
Yeah.
But it's very quite simple, but does have huge ramifications about one's about how one what one thinks of in life, I suppose. You know, that you are and you do until you die, you know, until your body breaks up.
Yeah.
So I think in physical terms as well, I think it's quite a nice thing.
Yeah, I have a tattoo on my left hand, and it's quite similar to what you're to the poem. And it basically just similar, but it basically means go with the flow. And we just kind of go and we do life. And we say yes to things, and because we've only got one life, and I think this is why I've accomplished certain things, because the pressure for me and I'm so self-aware about what life is and how long I have and all the things I want to achieve and all the things I want to learn and speak to, like yourself, and learn from everyone, because I'm such a curious person that I want to keep learning. And I think what the poem that you said is, we all must do what we must do until we collapse is so profound.
Exactly. No, I think it is very simple, but it does have huge ramifications. It makes you, the more you think about it, the more you, I think that's very good. You go with the flow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which really, I think I would adhere to as well, as a great, phrase really to keep on board, definitely.
And it seems like within your life and your career, you have just gone with the flow. Certain opportunities have come up, and you've gone, yeah, okay. And then you're acting as something, and then suddenly you're doing the movement direction, and it goes and snowballs from there.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it's a very good philosophy.
Mm, mm.
Yeah, it's much better than saying no.
Oh, definitely
I remember a tiny story, very quick story, actually. So I was just sailing. I love sailing as well. And I went with a guy. I was in America, in the States, and we were performing in New York, I think. And then we went up upstate New York to a lake. And I can't remember. I think it was people, the audience members or something. They invited us up for a weekend.
Mm.
And it was these two gay guys, I think, actually. And I went up with this friend of mine who was a stage manager, who was a lovely guy called Boogie Cork, who was an old friend of mine from way back.
Mm.
And we used to get friends to be stage managers, you know, just because it was good fun to have them on tour.
Mm-hmm.
This was with Movie Pitch Mime Show. And so we went sailing, and this couple, they had a couple of fireballs, which were an incredibly, they're like the elite sailing boats. They're really, really fast sailing yachts, mm-hmm. like small yachts, you know, small boats. Not quite dinghies, one stage up from dinghies, but they're incredibly fast. And so we went out, and it was a lovely day, and we went out for a sail. And I went with one of these guys, and Boogie went with the other guy. And basically the guy I went with was up for anything, you know. He was like, it was like quite a windy day, and so I called him fucking Will, and the other guy who would not, literally would pull the sails right in, let them go, you know, very, very slowly, and was complete opposite, and was called Better Not. So it was like fucking Will and Better Not, and it was just like and it was as clear cut as that. And so I had an amazing day sailing with this guy. We were like out on the trapezes, out on the sides, you know. Mm. And we go past this guy, and poor old Boogie, who was probably more into sailing than I was sitting very quietly in the back seat with this guy who would not risk anything, you know. It was just the antithesis of what we were doing.
Yeah.
And I never forget that. And so we called him fucking Will and Better Not. And it's like, you know, it's like that one person who will go to the ends of the earth, you know, to have fun, and the other guy who just will not, who put the clamps on, you know, for life.
Mm.
And that's what he was like in life, you know, as well.
Mm.
But it was just awful, because Boogie is like, he was such an opposite to that. He was such a guy who would just go for everything, you know.
Yeah.
And there he was being clamped up by this guy, by Better Not. It was a great, I just never forgotten that day. It was awful.
Such a great comparison of life, of how just to live life.
Yes, exactly. Especially with the wind, you know, with something like, it's like kite flying, or, you know, like sailing is such a extraordinary thing, because it can be, you know, it can be incredibly dangerous, yeah. But it's nature at its most powerful, really.
Well,
so there's that as well.
Yeah. Well, I want to say so much thanks to you, because it's been wonderful to chat to you and get to know you a bit better and know your processes, yeah, and stuff. And I want to say thank you, because it's been wonderful to, you're one of my biggest admirers for years and years and years and years and years since I've been growing up. So it's lovely to actually finally sit down and chat with you.
Oh, that's great, Jamie. Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
All right.
This is 360 Yourself, and I'm Jamie Neal. Thank you very much for taking a moment to listen to our wonderful guests. Please subscribe to our podcast to access all our brilliant guest episodes. They are released every Sunday at 12 p.m. We are available on all listening platforms: Spotify, Pocket Casts, Overcast, Google Podcasts, and Castro. You can also find us on Instagram at 360_yourself, Twitter at yourself360, and our host at Jamie Neal JN. Thank you for listening.